Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week, the founder of a group dedicated to getting more African-American stories into movie theaters, the legacy of compact discs, and how a particular kind of innovation ended up eating itself, and the musician Dr. John's journey from session player to New Orleans funk legend. But first,
in the early 1900s, photographer Edward Sheriff Curtis traveled around the country photographing North American Indians from 80 tribes. Those 2,000 or so sepia-toned images show Native Americans in tribal dress, stoic, facing the camera straight on, and mostly all not smiling. Well, now, a century later, comes a video in response to Curtis's photos. It's titled Smiling Indians, and it's exactly that, 4 minutes of video of Native Americans, young and old, with smiles ranging from a self-conscious grin to a full-on belly laugh. It was co-created by Ryan Redcorn. He's an Osage Indian from Oklahoma, and he joins me now from Tulsa. Welcome to the program, Ryan.
Well, thank you for having me.
You have dedicated this video to the photographer, Edward Sheriff Curtis. Did you mean that dedication sincerely? Was your tongue in your cheek there?
Yes, it would be fair to say it was tongue and or cheek.
Uh-huh. Well, why is that? What's your problem with those images from Edward Curtis?
Basically, they permeate every history book, you know, from the time that you enter grade school to even the documentaries that are shown on TV now. It becomes the dominant image that people, I mean, they imagine that Indians don't ever smile.
You know, it's interesting because when I look at those old photographs, I see images that seem to me very, very dignified, very prideful, unsmiling, yes, but most photographs from the early 1900s, people would not be smiling. It was a serious business to have your picture taken.
It's true, but unfortunately, that was kind of the end of the era of when people were taking pictures of natives. Even if you just Google Native American or Indian, you'll still come up with a ridiculous, lopsided inventory of what's out there.
There are babies smiling in this video. There are a few times when there's somebody who starts out looking very serious and then breaks into a grin. What were you telling people when you were trying to get them to smile or explaining what you were doing here?
I just told them I was shooting a video on smiling Indians. And
that worked.
And it pretty much works. I mean, it's like the prevalence of humor in Indian country is just right there on the surface. All the Indians I know are smiling Indians.
You have this message at the very end of your video. This message pops up. If you remember nothing else about me, remember that I smiled.
When I was editing the video, there was some gunshots or something that was going off across the street. And I thought, man, when we edit the video, your face hurts so much from just smiling from looking at all these images. And I thought, man, this is be a real poetic way to go out if I'm sitting here working on this video and a stray bullet comes in and takes me out. So I had this idea that if that happened, I was just going to type on my cell phone that if you remember nothing else about me, just remember that I smiled. And we decided to put it at the end of the video. It seemed fitting. It spoke to the heart of, what we were trying to have people walk away from.
Well, Ryan Redcorn, thanks for talking to us about it.
Well, I appreciate it.
Ryan Redcorn is the co-creator of the video Smiling Indians. You can watch that video and see photographs by Edward Sheriff Curtis at NPR.org.
Oscar season is over, and many movie artists of color are saying good riddance to this last year in cinema. The lack of diversity among the Academy Award nominees disappointed a number of people in the filmmaking community. But at the same time, members of a new generation of filmmakers say they are not waiting for Hollywood to recognize or include them. They're looking for their own vehicles to get their films made and in front of an audience. In a minute, we'll hear from the director of the largest Asian American-oriented film festival in the U.S. It starts tomorrow in San Francisco, and we'll hear more about it. But first, we'll talk about a new organization that's working to get a broader range of African-American films into theaters. The African-American Film Festival Releasing Movement, or AFFIRM, kicks off its efforts with the new movie I Will Follow. It stars Sally Richardson Whitfield as a successful black woman whose life is turned upside down by illness and death in her family. It also stars Blair Underwood. Here's a short clip.
You know, I got you so wrong. That's what really stuns me. How wrong I was about who you are.
Well, that goes both ways.
You're the one who left this relationship.
You're the one who left a home, a life, without any discussion.
What is there to discuss when someone is dying?
There are things to discuss.
That was Blair Underwood and Sally Richardson Whitfield in the film I Will Follow. It's the first film released as part of the African American Film Festival Releasing Movement, or AFFIRM. Ava DuVernay wrote and directed the movie, and she's also the founder of the organization, and she's with us now from NPR West. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, you were telling us earlier that you think that as far as the black film is concerned, that we're in both a state of emergency and a Harlem Renaissance moment. Explain that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's dire out here for black film in general. I mean, when you look at the Oscars and the lack of diversity, when you look at the fact that the studios have released one film so far this year starring a black woman, and it was Big Mama's House, you know, things aren't too good if you look at it from a studio perspective. But filmmakers of my ilk, independent filmmakers, are really looking at it from a place of open doors. All the traditional models are collapsing. And so for folks that are forward-thinking and are using their imaginations and their hearts instead of thinking about the bottom line, we can create new models of distribution, new ways to make our films, new ways to tell our stories, share our stories. So it's a good time.
Tell me a little bit more about what you're hoping to accomplish with AFFIRM. You're saying very intentionally and explicitly, this is not a film festival.
No. It's the African American Film Festival Releasing Movement. We call ourselves AFFIRM. And basically what it is an alliance of African American film festival organizations who have come together to say, look, we're film festivals. We have the apparatus, the infrastructure, the leadership, the resources in the community to do something beyond our 3-4-day festival. And we're going to come together and actually release a film theatrically as a unit. So these film festivals are essentially functioning as a studio in that they are the releasing company. This is the first time in history that a grassroots body has released a picture day and date, same day, not just for one day. This is a theatrical run. You can see the film at 11, 3, 5, 7, midnight in real theaters, and it's all powered by grassroots groups. This is not just a model for African American films. This is a model for Asian American films, Latino films, LGBT films, any films that are on the fringes that the studios are not embracing through their distribution efforts. This is a new way, a new possibility to think about how we can do it on our own.
That I think a lot of people are puzzled by is the fact that, you know, there are major stars in Hollywood. There are major figures who are being cast in all kinds of different films, like, you know, Anthony Mackie, for example, was in The Hurt Locker, which is won an Oscar for Best Director. It also was Best Film. And a lot of the films that people will talk about and pass around and watch at home, like Love Jones or Love and Basketball, you know, films like that. On the other hand, as you just said, there's been only one African-American-oriented film, which is Big Mama's House, which is this kind of broad farce. How can both those things be happening at once? How is it possible that you've got a whole, you know, other generation of people, Kerry Washington, Anthony Mackie, who are getting recognition, and yet these films so often, the films that are being released so often, trade in these broad stereotypes that a lot of people are sick of?
Well, I mean, I think, you look at someone like Anthony Mackie, who's in The Hurt Locker, that wins the Academy Award, and you wonder, okay, well, what's next for this brother, and what's next for the images that he might be able to present? And, you know, he's doing the Adjustment Bureau now, but he was also just in a film directed by a black woman called Night Catches Us, which was an independent, which had a limited release, a nice release, but it was limited, and so everyone might not have heard of that one. And so really what it's about is, you know, seeking out these films, seeking out the films that we want, and when they come, supporting them. They're there. You know, I think the answer to their question are, they are there. Well, it's just they may not be right in front of you.
And just to remind people who may not have caught it, we did an interview with the director of Night Catches Us, the writer and producer and director of Night Catches Us. And if you want to hear that conversation, you can go to our website. Just go to npr.org and click on the programs page and put in Night Catches Us. But what about those who argue that more films like that aren't being made because the audience... It's the audience driving it. What they want to see are, you know, car chases and things getting blown up.
Well, I disagree. I think that, you know, especially for the African-American film goer, there's not been a diverse presentation of images. That images that are presented by the studio system with large P&A budgets, that's print and advertising, are broad comedies or shoot 'em ups. And that it is challenging for anyone, white, black, or otherwise, to find these jewels, these pearls, these independent films that that do not have large budgets and are not kind of hitting people over the head with the fact that they're opening. So it's a challenge. I think that
that, you know, if there were a small, thoughtful art house picture or independent picture that was able to kind of expose itself to large numbers of African Americans, that we would go. And we've proven that we have in the past with something like A Love Jones, Love and Basketball. Those were independent films. They just had a good marketing push behind them. And when our folks knew that they were available, we went. I mean, you ask 90% of black folk what their favorite film is, it's going to either be Love and Basketball or Love Jones. And I think it's because those films portray contemporary images of ourselves. It's just black folks loving each other and living every day. And that's really what we're starved for, I think.
Well, talk about your film, too, that end. It's a very quiet film. There are no car chases. Nothing gets blown up. Tell us a little about how you chose this story.
Yeah, I Will Fall is a personal story. I come from a family of women, and so it really is a meditation on what happened when we lost one of our own. And so, yeah, I mean, it explores love and loyalty, you know, romantic love, familial love, self-love. It's an exploration through one day of a woman who's at a crossroads and has to kind of decide how to keep her balance when tragedy strikes. And so, you know, it's a film that is really a meditation. It's about matters of the heart. And so you probably won't die laughing or be scared at an explosion. But if you just want to see a drama with black people being black people as we are, no more, no less, that's the kind of film we've made, and that's the kind of film we're hoping to distribute through Affirm.
Ava DuVernay is the founder of the African American Film Festival Releasing Movement, or Affirm. She's also the writer and director of I Will Follow, the inaugural film from the organization, which opens in selected cities tomorrow. And she was kind enough to join us from our studios at NPR West. Ava DuVernay, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Jane Eyre is once again coming to life on film. Charlotte Bronte's gothic romance has already been adapted at least 27 times for movies and TV. It's the tale of the orphan Jane, who's never known kindness or affection, until that is she arrives as a governess at Thornfield Hall, the estate of one Mr. Rochester. There, Jane earns his love, even as she begins to wonder about a dark secret locked away in an attic.
This is a grand old house, but it can feel a little dreary. Mr. Rochester's visits are always unexpected.
Your gaze is very direct, Miss Anne. Do you think me handsome?
No, sir.
You're afraid of me.
I'm not afraid.
That's Judy Dench as the housekeeper, Mrs. Fairfax, Michael Fassbender as Rochester, and Mia Wasikowska as Jane Eyre. This most English of stories is told through the lens of a young American director, Cary Fukunaga. One of his earliest memories of film is, in fact, the 1943 Jane Eyre, starring Orson Welles and Joan Fontaine.
My mom loved the old black and white films, and, you know, since we had a VHS recorder, we were taping them off TV. And I remember Jane Eyre being one of the first ones we had. It's just dark and it's mysterious, and there's this mystery that's happening in the house, and it's finally revealed at the end. And as a kid, I really remember that moment of the woman being revealed in the attic and just being really shocked by it.
The demon.
Yeah, just whatever it was behind that wall, you know.
Yeah, it can be pushed to a degree into the horror genre.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the few versions that actually did that. Now that I know much more about other adaptations of the film and I've watched them, they often stay more in the safe realm of period romance drama. Because I think once you start mixing horror, it's very difficult to tell the audience what kind of film they're watching, because it's rare that you can promote a love story and feel fear in a film.
But in yours, one does. I jumped several times.
You did?
Yeah, seriously.
Good, good, good. That was definitely on purpose.
Let's play a scene with your Jane Eyre and Mr. Rochester. And Jane is quite pained. She believes she must leave Thornfield because Rochester is to marry another woman.
I have lived a full life here. I have not been trampled on. I have not been petrified. I have not been excluded from every glimpse of what is bright. I have known you, Mr. Rochester. And it strikes me with anguish to be torn from you.
Then why must you leave?
Because of your wife.
I have no wife.
But you are to be married.
Jane, you must stay.
I become nothing to you. Am I a machine without feelings? Do you think that because I am poor, obscure, plain and little, that I am soulless and heartless? I have as much soul as you and full as much heart. And if God had blessed me with beauty and wealth, I could make it as hard for you to leave me as it is for I to leave you.
The anguish here is so raw. She's so open, and it's the 1840s.
Well, I think it's her emotional intellect as well as her normal intellect that I think inspires Rochester and her awareness of her own feelings and her own value. I think Rochester says it in their first meeting that some of the things she says is so rare. She said not 3 in 3,000 schoolgirl governesses would say these things. I think her ability to point out what is oftentimes overlooked is something that he is absolutely attracted to.
One of the things about Jane Eyre that's appealed for 160 years is that she doesn't seem to care what people think in a way that even today people care a lot. Young girls, especially young women, care a lot about what people think. She cares about what she perceives of as the truth.
Mm-hmm. The truth is absolutely important. Despite growing up in an orphan or charity school, she somehow has come up with her own sort of vision of what life should be like, her own sense of morals, of right and wrong and truth. And she won't compromise that. Even if she's absolutely in love with Rochester, to live with him would go against her morals and against her respect for herself. She won't do that. And she's more willing to throw away that chance or that opportunity to live for love and respect herself. And I think that's rare today, even because people often compromise themselves in order to try to maintain a love, even if it destroys them.
You know, Rochester would seem to be an interesting character to cast because he's not a good guy. He's dissolute by his own admission. When it comes to casting him, in what ways must he be very compelling for you to even care about him or tolerate him or care about her love for him?
Well, I suppose traditionally you make him pretty. But I don't think you could describe Michael Fassbender as being traditionally pretty. He's a very rugged man. He's a man's man in that sense. I mean, I think what you look for there is a fierceness, and a fierceness that is covering for a lot of pain and sheer anguish. Everything he's done traveling the world and sort of drowning himself in sensations and women is to basically feed that need for his own love.
I'm asking what Jane Eyre would do to secure my happiness.
I would do anything for you, sir. Anything that was right.
You transfix me quite.
When you were making this film, did you think about Charlotte Bronte much, about who she was when she was thinking up these characters, this girl who was so articulate and so independent, and this tortured, romantic love of her life?
Yeah, I mean, the Bronte family in and of itself is an incredible story. They lived in this tiny parsonage surrounded by a cemetery in this small mill town. Her and her sisters and her brother would write these mini epic sort of fantasy novels on paper about 2 inches by 2 inches big, and their writing would be microscopic, and they just write these things. I mean, they had incredible imaginations. There's this scene in Jane Eyre where Jane talks about the limited horizon that women have and that men get to go wander the world, but they have to stay there. And I think that it's hard to separate Charlotte from Jane. When you write fiction, you're allowed to write or rewrite reality. I think Charlotte's life ended tragically because when she finally did find love, and finally was able to have a child, she died from complications in the pregnancy. And I remember some of the letters she wrote to her friends talking about, the misery she was going through in the pregnancy and the fear she had of what could potentially happen and what came true. It's actually quite sad. I think the father is the only one that survived out of all the children.
And the books.
And the books. Obviously, the books are immortal.
And now the latest in our series on music formats. 2010 was another terrible year for the music industry, and in particular for the CD. Sales of compact discs dropped last year by almost 20%. For a while, they lifted the fortunes of the recording industry to new heights. But as NPR's Joel Rose reports, the CD also contained the seeds of the industry's collapse.
At the end of the month, the last CD will roll off the line at a Sony factory in New Jersey. At its height, the plant employed 1,300 people, cranking out hit albums like Michael Jackson's Bad.
The overtime was just, you had it whenever you wanted it. 10-hour days if you wanted it, Saturdays, Sundays, you could get it. That's how busy we were. And a lot of times it was mandatory. It was posted. You had to work, and that was it.
Jim Jones drives a forklift at the Sony factory in Pittman, New Jersey, a job he's had since 1982 when the plant still made LPs. It's also where Jones met his wife, Cindy. Back in the 1990s, they worked in the warehouse together, rushing out hit CDs.
I can't remember the last one. I mean, it's been so long since there was a big hit. It's just slow.
Sony will still make CDs at its factory in Indiana, but the closure of the New Jersey plant is telling. Sales of compact discs have fallen 50% over the past decade. We're a long way from 1983, when Casey Kasem introduced the CD to his radio audience like this.
When it comes to technology, improvements never end. But lately, in the field of recording, they may have come up with the last link in the chain of evolution, the compact audio disc.
The CD was invented by hardware manufacturers Sony and Philips. At first, executives at the major record labels didn't like the new format, but they started to come around, thanks in large part to Jack Holzman, the founder of Elektra Records, who will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next week. Holzman was a big advocate for the CD when he was at Warner Music Group.
The CD was sexy, and it would bring higher prices from about $8 for cassettes or LPs at the end of the 70s to about $15 in the early 80s. You could resell your best catalog again. CDs were lighter and cheaper to ship, which is a big consideration.
All that meant giant profits for the music industry in the 1980s and 90s, says Steve Knopper. He's the author of Appetite for Self-Destruction, the spectacular crash of the record industry in the digital age.
The CD sold so well, and it created this gigantic boom in the industry, and everybody got rich, and people just got incredibly accustomed to this. To the point where in the late 90s, the only way that you could get the one song that you liked was to buy the $15 to $18 CD at the Tower Records.
At first, Knopper says people didn't mind paying a lot for the new format.
You didn't hear the outcry at that time of, you know, hey, we're getting price gouged here. Instead, the public was going, this is much better sound.
Record labels promised that the price of CDs would come down eventually, and the discs did get cheaper to make. But the labels kept retail prices and profits high. Jack Holzman says that was a mistake.
It's fine to keep that up for 2 or 3 years, but the labels kept it up far too long. And I think it was a fraud on the public and on the artists.
Oh, yeah, I think they shot themselves in the foot. $18 was just ridiculous.
Still, Larry Haas says he prefers CDs. In fact, he's shopping for used discs at the Princeton Record Exchange in New Jersey. So is Scott Gordon.
There's a certain thing about holding it in your hand. As long as this store is here and I'm breathing, I'll be here probably 4 times a year.
Hardly enough to bring back the glory days of the CD. Sales peaked in the year 2000. Back when the disc was designed, no one in the music industry thought much about ripping or burning on a personal computer. Then came the MP3 and Napster and all of the other peer-to-peer networks. But the CD hasn't faded out yet.
It is still our bread and butter.
John Lambert is the general manager at the Princeton Record Exchange. He says sales of new CDs have declined dramatically, but the store makes up for it with a brisk business in used discs, especially in the $5 and under section.
Probably the biggest fallout from the downloading mentality is it became more a singles market and people were willing to pay a couple dollars for those songs off a new album, but they weren't willing to pay $18 for a new CD.
Lambert says he wouldn't be surprised if new releases on CD slow to a trickle in the next 10 years as record labels turn their attention to so-called cloud-based music services.
And next week, a new group of musicians will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We're taking a look at the 5 very different performers who will be inducted. Today we'll hear about a session player who got bored and created a mysterious stage character dressed in feathers and beads. David C. Barnett of member station WCPN reports on the making of Dr. John.
The recording studio was crammed with musicians, some of the best players in Los Angeles, gathered to provide a wall of sound behind Sonny and Cher.
Little man, when you stand.
Behind the tall woman and the little man were multiple guitarists, horns, and keyboard players. Among that last group was a 26-year-old pianist from New Orleans named Mac Rebenek, and he was not too happy with the assignment.
To get all these keyboard players, and they're all good players, playing blink-oom, 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 arpeggios together, it's not very hip, and it's not very funky. It doesn't make me want to dance.
And Mac Rebenek knew funky. He had studied at the feet of New Orleans legends like Professor Longhair. But Rebenek had been busted for drugs one too many times, and the authorities refused to let him return home after rehab. So he went to L.A., where there was plenty of mind-numbing session work. To escape, he started thinking back to New Orleans and a story he had heard about a 19th century medicine man revered by the poor and feared by the well-to-do. His name was said to be John Montaigne, more commonly known as Dr. John.
They call me Dr. John, known as a night tripper. A saddle of gris in my hand.
In 1969, Mac Rebennec released a thematic album called Gris-Gri, based on the Dr. John character. The record was a mixture of rhythm and blues, jazz, and voodoo chants in a Creole dialect. It was recorded quickly by a group of expatriate New Orleans musicians during leftover Sonny and Cher studio time. For Rebennec, the hardest part was stepping out in front to do the lead vocals.
See, I don't know nothing about singing. I never wanted to be a front man. Front men had big egos and was crazy and aggravating. I just never thought that was a good idea.
But no one else wanted to do it either, so Rebennec reluctantly became Dr. John.
Walk on pins and needles, see what they can do. Walk on gilded splinters with the cane of the Zulu. Dang, I'm in a
When he started touring, friends from New Orleans' Mardi Gras Indians provided him with elaborate costumes, festooned with feathers and intricate beadwork. Rebennec says his goal was to preserve and promote a cultural legacy that was dying off. But the mysterious music of Dr. John connected with psychedelic rockers.
We got some gigs playing at a Love Inn or a Bee Inn or some kind of inn.
Did I boy it up? Did I boy it up?
Since then, Dr. John's wardrobe has been scaled back to a snake-headed walking stick and some voodoo beads. And the music is straight-up funky New Orleans. But he's kept the name that he took from that ancient medicine man.
Listen, Doc has been my name all my life, and John is my middle name. I'm proud of all of my names. Malcolm John, Michael Crow Rabinet, and Junior. Add that to it.
And the formerly reluctant lead vocalist has settled into his role as Dr. John.
Yes, that's the technology of life.
For NPR News, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.